Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of entrepreneurs who, let's be honest, I feel like a lot of us have been a little arrogant. We have the sense that, hey, we're entrepreneurs. We're running startups. We know so much more than these bigger dinosaurs that we're going to take over. Well, joining me today is an entrepreneur who started several companies, did really well for himself, and said, you know, these bigger companies, they want a piece of this startup action too. They get that there's innovation happening at the smaller scale. And so David Kidder, that's the person you're going to get to know today, co-founded. I've got such a big note that he does not want all the credit for creating this company on his own. He is the co-founder of Bionic. They seed and launch startups. And I invited him here to talk a little bit about that, to talk a lot also about the companies that he's built leading up to this. He's also an author of a few books that I've seen. Actually, it's a devotional book. The intellectual devotional that has been especially big, and he also has a startup playbook. I invited him to talk about all of this, to learn from his experience, to hear his stories, and we could do it thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first will host your website, right? It's called HostGator. The second, if you're hiring developers, you need to know them. It's called TopTal. David, before we get into all of this, how's your hair still so freaking perfect when I know what you're going through today?
That's fine. I don't have height or any other superpowers other than the fact that I stole my hair, but no, I don't know. Maybe it's the air. No, I'm always careful not to sort of timestamp these conversations, but this one is such a big deal that it is. It's that we're going through a corona madness for sure. And so we're home today. We have a big, beautiful office in the city, New York City, in Union Square, but we're about, I think, to move to a stage where we need to do what's right and lower the infection rate around all of us. And just five miles up the road is the National Guard locking down New Rochelle, and I live in Rye. But it's we're going to go through an unprecedented moment in history today
because there's so many coronavirus cases in New Rochelle.
Yeah, it's actually one of the densest areas in the country, sort of epicenter of it right now, and so they're tracking it very closely and trying to restrict movement, and they're using, you know, all the tools available.
So in all seriousness, how do you deal with it on a personal level with the stress of this? And we should get into how you sold your company. There's so many great stories here, but I feel like I'm catching you at a moment where there is a little bit of stress, and it's an opportunity to get into your mindset, how you're dealing with stress.
I try to, I live in abundance and not fear. Honestly, I respect fear is a good motivating force in your life. It can, you know, instinctually keep you alive. I guess it's a very important quality, but it also, it's really hard to perform and think clearly through a lens of fear. And so, you can't let it get inside. You can look at it and respect it, but you have a lot more control and usually, than you have on managing yourself, your emotions and planning for that. And so I try to focus on the things that I can control. But and staring at the truth, but not letting it get inside the company or myself.
And David, you mean physically, like in your mind, you might see a thought that says, oh, my kids are not going to be able to go to school for a few days. What if one of them gets corona? What if I get it? And so on. You just have to say to yourself mentally, stop paying attention to that. Recognize that it exists in your head. Focus on this other thing. I think I just lost you. Did you change your audio as you said something?
I'm right here. Sorry. Yeah. Because I'm home, there's I have three sons and they're active to say the least.
You've got a great mic. Don't worry about it.
Great. I am absolute real-time voracious input reader. You know, I've read as much as anyone, I think, right now that has the releases in I have a 55-person company in my awareness. And I also kind of participate in a couple of communities who are also founders and they're talking about this topic. And so my general awareness of what's happening is pretty high. And I'm sort of helping my leadership team, my management team on considering when to make a set of cascading decisions right now. And so I'm following the partner's lead, but I'm also following the things that I think culturally are important for us right now around safety.
All right. I had a question that I wrote down for you months ago when we first talked to ask you as the first question. It was about Smart Ray. You started it, you sold it, and then the day the wire went through, do you remember that?
I do, yes.
What happened?
So we had been building a company for about 2 years, raised about $5 million capital, about 30 people, lots of engineering, building basically an alerting platform on top of a company called TIBCO, which was an big, huge data bust back in the dot-com boom that powered like Yahoo and Instanet and Reuters and NASDAQ and others. In any case, how you get information to your mobile device back then, which barely existed, was hard because you have atomic levels of data, fire hose data, and you're picking out one specific event out of this universe of data and applying it to send it to a device, so to speak. And so we built that, and we ended up having effectively a deal for the company, and it was a little under $80 million, and we had no revenue, and it was phenomenal. And we ended up like having a purchase point adjustment in that contract for closing that said if we became greater than 10% of the market share of the company acquiring us, which we thought was impossible because it was worth billions and we were small by comparison, they could get out of it. And of course, right in the middle of our closing, or the last 5 inches of it, the market started to crash. The first ceiling tiles sort of fall in for the dot-com boom, and that company ended up exercising that right, and we had like a month to scramble, and we ended up selling the company for a little over half as much. But I remember taking the ride of the elevator down to the bottom floor. You know, I hadn't told anybody about the deal, but you know, seeing tens of millions, not in person, but for the company, just evaporate in things you don't control was just one of those almost unstomachable moments, because the decade ahead of your life would be either really good or completely starting over after, you know, spending a decade killing myself to get there. So it was a really one or zero moment, and we had to hustle, but we got through. It taught me a lesson on control, what you could do, and also how much you can affect when you go all in.
You were acquired by LifeMonitors?
Yeah, it was a company that was doing basically email marketing before that was a thing. They had raised a lot of money. They were about $1.5 billion in value. They were the second part of the wave. And there was a very famous portal that was in the first wave called about.com. And so it was based in New York. And I was actually, ironically, still very close friends with the founders and CEOs of that company today.
So it was About that had an opportunity to buy you.
Yeah.
And it was LifeMinders that did. By the way, LifeMinders was my biggest sponsor back in when they were around.
There
I got
go.
Millions yeah. of dollars in checks from them because
I know.
It was, did you know that? They, or did,
I did
you just
know
that they would
awesome.
Do that?
It was, yeah, they were...
It was a company that would, they wanted to acquire new email subscribers. I would acquire email subscribers for them at a price of $1 to $5 per. They would then go public. At least that was the model at the time. At like, they were a valuation of $10 per subscriber, $20 per subscriber is how the market valued them. And so it was a no-brainer for them to buy from us. And the first check that came to me from them was for $300,000. And I couldn't believe that they would actually send so much money. I kept calling them up. I interrupted a board meeting to make sure that I was really going to get paid.
Yeah, they're good guys. I was very grateful. I mean, listen, we were very fortunate. But, you know, that was a different era. And perception was reality back then. And now we're going back. But, I mean.
So, wait, how much did you sell to them for?
I think total was just a little under 40.
40. And then how much of that did you get to keep back then? Did you get anything?
Yeah, I was actually able to collar quite a bit of it. So I was able to get, and I had two other co-founders, but you know, we raised a little bit of money. But it was a good outcome. And
wait, so you got it? What'd you end up with? What, let's say $5 million is what you ended up in their stock?
It's not public, but it was enough. Put it that way. And then
you got collars for it, which means what? You bought because you weren't allowed to sell?
Yeah, a collar is a transaction product. A lot of traders will use that wrap a stock in its value, high and low, right? So you can, the trader will take a risk that if it drops below a price, they'll take the risk of losing money, but you won't lose money. But they also take the upside, which is if it goes up, you won't receive a certain amount above a certain amount of upside. So you get a window, a trading window of value, and then they can get the downside and upside based on the vehicles of trading. So they could short or go long, or flip the script, depending on what they believe the future is for that company. But they trade that risk, and you get de-risked. And so that's an example of that. And so, you know, we're able to kind of preserve even during the crash about how that played out. So it was a good thing for me. I've taken time off and traveling.
Why did you do it? Were you worried that this whole thing that you spent? How long did you spend building it?
I was at about 26, 27 at the time, and it was my second company I had founded, and I kept kind of rolling the dice, you know, taking what I made, selling a company, putting it into another one. So, you know, you're 27, 28, and with one of the great runs in the market history, which we just ended today, by the way, today's officially a bear market, 11 years. In that case, it was seven. You know, at some point, you got to take money off the table and you have to secure some part of your future. And so it's critical to get those things right when you have them. Because honestly, exits are rare. People have this perception you build and sell a company. Companies are bought, they're not sold. And it's very rare that it actually happens. And so you have to get good at being on the right side of the curve of that in timing and creating market demand for what you're doing, which is as much a skill as is building a company, and then making sure that you capture it when it happens, because it's easy to lose both the transaction but lose the value in it.
How'd you find a second acquirer then?
We had worked with an investment bank called Broadview back then, and it was a technology bank, so we had really good advice. And banking, to some extent, is like the most perfectly priced product in the world, right? You buy every time, but you hate writing the check because it's insurance against leaving money on the table or not getting a deal done. But their job really is relationship. So what appears to be not a lot of work on their part is really, you know, decades in many cases of relationship building and trust. They are the insurance, and you have to be willing to pay that to make sure that you max value or guarantee something gets closed.
Okay, so I want to get a sense of where you were to get there. I read that your first tennis racket you bought on layaway, you ended up with the paper route, you worked as a lifeguard to make even more money. Is this because your parents were trying to teach you the value of hard work or because you needed the money?
It's funny that you're pulling from some good research. It's a lot of interviews. Well done. No, I mean, listen, I had a family of four. My dad was worked for the state, he was a psychologist. My mom was a writer. We didn't have a lot, but we had a happy home. And, so whatever I wanted, I had to earn. And so I grew up in upstate New York where you had like lake effect snow. So a paper route in upstate New York is not like a paper route anywhere else. It's like, you might as well be in Wisconsin. It's like 6-7 days a week, you know, up at 5 a.m. on your little BMX bike, carrying big, thick papers, you know, 20, 30 papers, houses. And then every, you know, once a month or once every 2 weeks, you go and collect and you're getting paid in quarters, you know, for this delivery service. You got to collect the money, buy the papers, deliver them. So it was a tough, but it was freezing because you get dumped on by snow and, you know, you have to get there. So you'd be plodding there. So that was one of my first jobs, and it taught me a lot of lessons about getting up early and working hard, and worked, you know, as a farmhand. And then I was like, this is too hard. So I got to learn how to swim and became a lifeguard for a summer. And then I worked in a sports store. And so I just kind of sort of leveled up, trying to figure out how to maximize my time and energy.
Did you work for Kodak?
Yeah. So during college, I studied industrial design at RIT, and which is a really interesting interdisciplinary school in engineering and science and art and design. And I was awarded this award called called the ID Magazine, which is kind of it was kind of like architectural for design, and won a student world international design competition and got an opportunity to work at Kodak for the summer. And it was awesome. But it was like the beginning of the end for Kodak. We were designing digital cameras, which was the first generation. And then I realized that I very quickly knew I did not want to work in a large organization, like a little Veal cube. And I started working the next summer, actually almost immediately after, for a company called The Idea Group, which was using technology like Pro Engineering and Silicon Graphics boxes to do design and engineering. So that was my first bite at the startup, and that helped me get connected to SGI when they got into the Web4 space with the box, the serving boxes for the web, when it first began. And we built a service and technology company for agencies way back in the beginning, 95, 96, and we sold that and then did a roll back to Omnicom.
What was NetX?
Yeah. That first company, I was 20 years old. It was 1996, and we had just started building tools and services for people who were required to build web-based interfaces back when the internet just started.
Wait, you created the software that companies like Xerox and Bausch & Lomb and others used to create websites?
In this context, it was with the agencies. It was with Y&R. It was with...
Rubicon.
O'Connor's was really the tool set where when the digital agencies went into the space, they had nothing. And so we became their something.
I mean, the software that they used to create what?
The services and the tools to do web-based advertising back when it first came out.
Banners, largely.
No, it's really the websites themselves. It was, you know, it really manifested. It was almost like prior to, you know, the services and the technology behind, like, you know, Microsoft Front Page, you know, like the drag and drop type of tools. But it was really, you know, it was a small business, and we ended up getting across the finish line. And then I helped do a roll up. I joined a team backed by Omnicom. We took public, which was called Think New Ideas, that did a roll up of all internet digital service companies, and grew that. And I'm very close with the friends who both started it, but also scaled it. I was there for about 3 or 4 years, and then I began my next company called SmartRay, which is where we kind of began the story.
How big of an exit was NetX?
Small, in the single-digit millions.
Shares?
I was about 21, 22.
Yep. And did you end up with shares of Think New Ideas?
No, I actually joined the team that took it public. So I was part of the leadership team that scaled it. And that was my first. That was my first, like, real kind of startup job, and it was a very interesting company for a variety of reasons. But inside of that company, I built some friends that I still. I have a couple of my closest friends in the world who are all part of my life now, who I met in the trenches there for years, and then I started.
But you were with them till just before the dot-com bubble burst. Right?
No, I left in with.
I thought you left January 99.
Yeah, 2 years, probably, because we sold SmartRay in 2001. I actually have it on my wall here. 2000. Okay. So I left in late 98, early 99. So January. So let's call it January 99. Looking at the wall, this history date here. So it was about a year and a half, probably 2 years before, honestly, the real kind of crash happened.
The thing that I'm trying to understand is, how did you become a guy who did well and still understood, I better have a collar for these shares that I sold because this is not going to last forever? How did you have the foresight to do that?
I was happening while we went through these transactions. It was the beginning of the end, and it was at that point you were kind of just trying to secure an outcome. You know, you knew that the sort of honestly, it would be equivalent to today, even, you know, in the last like week, you'd be like, right, this is, we're now on the other side of a historic curve. And I don't know if that's going to take 5 years, could take 10, but, you know, it's not going to be a year, you know, so
lock it down. When you see that it's going downhill, just lock it down before you fall all the way down that hill. And that's what you were thinking.
Yeah. Secure what you have. You know, even today I have Bionic is a, 55 person company and bootstrapped and no investors and growing. And, you know, I feel very strong about our offering the world, but the world's changed. And I, ironically, even in the last week, it feels like it's, there's even more demand for what we do because it kind of works in good and bad times. When you throw the cards in the air, you know, they resettle. It's really, you got to rediscover where your growth is going to come from. And Bionic solves that problem. So I feel very bullish about where our position, the problem we're solving, but also equally, you know, you're in for a very different chapter with wind at your back versus, you know, wind at your face as a marketplace.
Okay. So you're saying that you sold SmartRay and then you took off. What did you do?
I started in Tibet and I traveled to a couple dozen countries for the next year and a half, 2 years in,
wow.
Yeah, did most of the Serengeti migration, most of India, most of China. It was really Southeast Asia. It was really incredible. It's just got a chance to really unwind, but also see the world. And knowing that I probably would never get the chance to do that again, it was really just get lost in the world. And back then, you had no mobile phone. You just went, and so you'd go to an internet cafe every you know week or two, and you were alone with yourself in many cases. It was just awesome to, you know, stare that down and experience things and let it really affect you.
You did this on your own.
Yeah, I did a lot of it on my own, but I also had some of it professionally planned because you don't just show up in Burma, right, or Laos. You actually, you got to have people who know the area. You can't just show up in Lhasa or Tibet without, you know, visas and special passes, even back then. So you had some of it had to be professionally planned and some not.
And then what type of place did you stay in?
You know, I had a backpack, but it was the sort of the top of it was you could travel anywhere. And so I could, you know, kind of, I imagine I would look like a classic sort of backpacker, but the bottom, you know, had a bunch of Prada stuff in it. So what I would do is I'd go away for, you know, a couple of weeks and rough it. And then I got a chance to stay at some of the best hotels in the world. I just stay for 3 or 4 to 5 days and, you know, recover, so to speak, and really enjoy, you know, a first world experience in a third world country. And then I'd get back on the road. So it was this.
I did that same thing. I didn't go away to college. I'd never had this like fun experience. And I said, you know, I have an opportunity to go to stay at hostels. So I took my backpack and I would stay at hostels and it was great. And then I would have enough of that. And I'd go spend a few days at the nicest hotel I could get where the bathroom was clean and I could have a little bit of space and be pampered and then go back. I didn't do it quite as long as you did. I did not find myself. I lost myself there. This whole anxiety that I had around the stuff that I didn't get to do because I sacrificed it for work went away by the end of that trip. What happened to you? How did you come out differently at the end of this?
Well, I think I realized a couple of things. One is the world is really small and it's deeply interconnected. I mean, you're seeing this today with the virality of you know, disease, quite frankly. The world's tiny. You know, you think it's big and things are far away, but the knock-on effect of policy and decisions from the top all the way down to the local communities has effects that we feel. And even, you know, leaders who have personality conflicts, you're seeing this in the oil markets today, can reshape the whole world. And so the whole concept of like anti-fragile versus fragile, I think I learned way the world was much more fragile than you believe it is.
What do you mean? What led you to think that?
Well, decisions. I mean, if you look at multiple decade generational effects of war, for example, and landmines and policy decisions, that the people pay the price of that today, like as if you know it happened yesterday. So there's a shortism versus the longism view of the world on decision making that you have to balance your understanding of how much effect you actually have in your decisions and how much effect little decisions have. And I think that was a huge awakening for me, was both velocity, speed, and interconnectedness of the world that we feel today, but I think I've realized throughout my life after going through those experiences.
All right, let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor, then we'll come back and see what you did after this trip. My first sponsor is HostGator. I'm going to actually ask you, if you were to start today or build a business today with nothing but a hosting package, what would you recommend?
As a hosting package?
Nothing but a hosting package. You start right now. We're going into a recession. The economy's bad. What if I gave you nothing but a hosting package and said, now you've got to start your life over, what would you do? I'll tell you what I would do.
I can just tell you, this is very macro, but it's, I have always been the most successful in wherever my obsession was, whatever I most deeply cared about. Mm-hmm. And so that's one. Second is what are your ideas to solve that problem, right? That need. And, you know, my book series or Bionic, these other companies have always been really kind of original inventions. And so the answer to the question is really, what do you most deeply care about? And, valuing your solution to it. Because wherever your whole mind is, where that 10 hours feels like 1 hour, where that truth is, I think people don't realize it's not just the hours, it's not working hard. It's you need the whole person, this conscious, subconscious, the sleeping, waking hours to break through to create value. So I don't care if it's a website or a service or an outcome, you have to tap into that type of energy from you in the need to unlock something that can be successful. It's not about chasing white space or making dollars or money. It's if you're going to build a business and light up a website, it has to be something that unlocks that proprietary gift that you have.
You know what? For me, my wife saw that I had a book on my book stand last night because I was preparing for an interview. And so I'm constantly thinking about it. But for me, to figure out that this was going to be the thing that I was excited about, or to figure out my previous business that was going to be the thing that I was excited about, I had to just try a bunch of things. Like Mixergy wasn't I have a passion for interviews. I'm going to start with interviews. I would have thought this would make no sense for me. But I tried a bunch of different things, and this just, I fell in love with it, largely by interviewing people I used to do business with and being fascinated by the stuff I didn't know about them. And so if anyone out there is listening to us and you don't know what your passion is right now, I'd suggest that one of the first things you do is get a hosting package that allows you to build lots of different sites so that you can explore and experiment and find the thing that gets you. And if you need a thing to start with, especially right now, I say your personal reputation and your name is the most important thing to start off with. If you just build a website that says nothing but here's my face, here's who I am, and here are links out, you've started your reputation. You've given people like me who are researching you something to grab hold of and get to know you. And now if you've given yourself, in addition to that, a way of creating other websites, you could explore other ideas and feel free to delete them. It's not a failure. It's just another experiment. All right. If you want to get started with HostGator, go to hostgator.com/mixergy. They'll give you the lowest price that they have and a great hosting package that you can count on. Super low, easy way of starting a business and expanding your reputation. hostgator.com/mixergy. And of course, you'll get $100 in advertising from them. Go look at that offer at hostgator.com/mixergy. All right, you come back. What do you do next? How do you get back into the world of business?
You know, I meet my wife, which was life changing, of course. And I was ready to like start that chapter of my life. And our life has been a complete, you know, sprint. It's amazing, from dogs and kids and homes and companies and, you know.
You mean you guys are still together?
Yeah, wow. 18 years now, three boys, 9, 12, and 14.
Okay.
And our life is a kind of a wild, big life. It's, we travel a ton. She's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Genderfair that uses data to, show equality in large organizations relative to the Millennium Goals for Women. And so she's very active and passionate about that. And then, you know, I do a lot of travel for work. And so when our boys are very active, it's like three big line clubs. So it's a kind of a crazy life. And so from there, and did a bunch of investments, helped get some companies off the ground. And then I got the band back together from the SmartRay days and started Clickable, which was really around the idea of something called an ACT engine, which was actual analytics back when that was sort of a thing in 2007. So back then, there was an arms race of Google and Yahoo and Microsoft to win the search engine wars. And Google obviously won the grand majority of that. But back then, there was a lot of friction across the networks. And then you had social media coming on.
What do you mean by friction across the networks?
Just everybody had a different tool set. So to get good at one, you had to be good at three tools. So it'd be like...
For advertising on them.
Yes, correct.
Because Yahoo had just bought GoTo.com, which was the impetus for Google's AdWords. And so if anyone was going to advertise in those two platforms and then throw in a third one, which was Microsoft, which seemed to have a chance, it was learn each one of their interfaces and then... From what I remember, too, having interviewed people who'd been in the space, it was getting the data back from all those interfaces in a way that allowed you to do something with it. And that's what you saw.
We were solving that. And also the recommendations of like what to do. So how does that, you know, how you're doing what you need to do to improve every single day across the platforms, regardless of the tool set and the data. So it was very early. We patented that, and it actually worked out quite well. And is that me or you? What is that coming from? I apologize.
I don't recognize that beeping.
I don't either.
Oh, no. I hope it's not like a national emergency.
You know what it is? I apologize.
What is it?
It's my surge suppressor.
Oh, okay. Funny? Got it. I was thinking maybe it was a bigger issue than that.
That's strange. So just to back up. Our Clickable was building an interface with an actual recommendation engine across the search networks when they were complex. And it turned into be a monopoly. And so for Google in a way. And so it was very...
But before we get into that, how did you know? Sorry to keep slowing you down, dude. I'm fascinated by your life. you know, the other thing that I like about you, we've talked a couple of times under like stressful situations where you had something else going on. We couldn't record the interview. No, I could see in you how stressed you were. And then I don't think I've seen this in anyone else to your degree. You said, well, stop, Andrew. Tell me a little bit about how you're doing right now. I go, dude, you just told me you got a crisis. I said we can reschedule. You said, I just want to check in with you. I go, who the fuck does that?
It's the humanity of you're a founder entrepreneur in this, you're in the same journey. So everybody has their moments, you know.
So thank you, by the way, for even being with me here today, considering it feels like every time we talk, there's something going on.
Isn't it funny? I mean, it's funny because I've had the last 6 years, I've had a very easy run. I mean, this company's been a breeze. And then I think because of the last year, I think people were starting to build in an acceptance that the bull run was over, or at least conditions around it. And then we now legitimately have probably the first black swan event of our lifetimes, or second at least. I mean, I think the home mortgage crisis of 2000, 2008 are real. But this is a very unusual event. So the conditions around this are something there's a lot of unknown unknowns in all of this. And I think that's very disruptive.
Yeah, it is. And even though I know I'm going to be okay no matter what happens, I do find myself getting stressed a little bit about it. And there's nothing I could see a few bad things happening, but I know intellectually it's not. And still I'm finding myself with a low level of stress. Even my wife saying that her friends canceled on her for Friday night dinner because they can't get together in person is adding a level of stress to me.
I think you have to take this very seriously. I think this is one of those cases where you can't assume it's like anything else that you've experienced in your life. So it's absolutely new information. Fundamentally new information. And so your assumption set, right, about what it's like to be ill or manage illness, or you know your awareness of just day-to-day in infection, so to speak, has to change. And I don't think that you people will recognize that is required. And so you either can be on the side of, oh, it's no big deal and nothing, and then be on the negative side of that, or accept it knowledgeably for what it is, the risk, and then make the changes, because it's all a question of like, what state of preparedness do you want to be in? And do you want to be right or wrong? So I think this is a case where it's true for business too, which is, we have this thing we use called pre-mortems. And pre-mortems are tools that imagine a really catastrophic outcome. And the reason why you need to do that is because it's insurance against decision-making. I just learned this in a keynote we had at the Binex Summit last week, around a concept called tilt. And when you look at particular poker or other types of game theory, when you have asymmetrical information, you know a lot, I know a little, I know a lot, you know a little, or you and I both know a little, and there's a lot that's out there that's unknown, one of the things that leads to catastrophically bad decision-making is something called tilt. And then tilt has two qualities. The first quality is optimism. And secondly is overconfidence. So overconfidence and optimism lead to really bad results when you are dealing with challenging moments. And so
I see you've got a family member. Go ahead.
And so you have to be very careful in these moments to make decisions with clarity. A pre-mortem is a really good tool to stop and say, how bad could this be? Or how good it is. But in this case, how bad it is, because if you can imagine a future where it goes really, really bad, then you can fix it. You know how to fix it. You know how to deal with it, how to prepare for it. It's no longer an unknowable fear. You've imagined it. Okay, great. Now let's solve it. And that's empowering in a way. You're like, okay, well, that's the worst that can happen. It never happens as bad as you think it is. But you can actually have a lot of control in what you do right now. That's why it's so important to be balanced in this moment when you're dealing with these situations. And I think being prepared is a huge advantage in your mindset. This is for business or, you know, in our sort of public and personal lives in these type of moments.
All right. I hate to go back to the story, but I want something that will outlive this situation. And so wondering was...
Don't know why that's going. Again, let me fix that.
How did you know that this was an issue? You're a guy coming off of this long disconnect from the world where you have to go into an internet cafe to even get internet access. How did you know that there's such a problem that you need to connect all these different platforms together into one ad buying place and one data and all that? How did you know it was an issue?
I stay close to the advertising world. I have friends. I'm in New York. It's a big industry here. And back then ad tech and MarTech were hot, and now they're not, but back then it was a really big opportunity. So I don't know. I just stayed close to it and listened. I mean, it's one of those things. I also realized that it was accessible for me. Part of getting to secrets in business is because you're part of an ecosystem where the secrets live. So if you have friends, in my case, who know a lot of the agency people who are using those tool sets, you just happen to be in a place where you're like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that it takes so many people to do that job. You're like, wow, yeah. Or the APIs are coming out and the API complexity. It's an arms race on all the APIs. Everyone's spending, you know, the same dollars to build the same tools over and over and over again. So you have 100 agencies who, quote unquote, all have technology writing and doing the same thing.
And did you do this intentionally where you were talking to your friends with an idea to start a business, or were you just listening to see what they were complaining about?
Pretty much the latter, which was listening to the pain.
All right. I think you were starting to tell us that the eventual winner of this whole race was Google. And how did that affect your business?
It wasn't great. I mean, one of the things we got to about 180 people and we raised about $34 million. We ended up building basically two companies at once. And, you know, it also inspired what became a Startup Playbook, which is I went out during those years and started interviewing my friends and their friends on how to bet their life. And it really informed me how to think about not only my business back then, but also today. And so it was one of the great learning experiences of my life to go through the scaling of that. And then we ended up selling part of it back to our partner in Amex, and part of it we merged it with another company, because it's really hard to build a company when you're in someone else's monopoly. You really have to own almost all of your revenue, all of your destiny, all of your relationship with your customers to make a business work, because it's really ultimately their need that you're serving. And so when you get infrastructural blocks between you and the customer, it's you're sort of listening through a wall, right?
Yeah.
You're listening to the customer through a wall. And that's almost impossible to solve for. So we did a couple successful pivots. And we ended up splitting the company. And then I was sort of done. And I did these interviews and created this book called The Startup Playbook, which was what came out of that were this concept of the five lenses. So when I asked, you know, Elon or Sarah Blakely
wasn't Reid Hoffman?
Reid Hoffman, who wrote the four in the book, how do you bet your life? They effectively all said within the first two or three years, if a startup passes through these five lenses, these five criteria, they all become successful. And it's basically this. The first is proprietary gift, which is what is the unfair advantage? What do you have that no one in the world has? And if an idea, which is a solution to a problem, and the question of why you, that successfully passes through it, you have something that actually leads to unfair advantage, which is what you need to survive. Two is extreme focus. How does the team skill and energy focus on a single customer problem and not multiple problems? You know, optionality in a way is your enemy when you're doing too much. You only have a certain amount of resources. The third was you got to build painkillers and not vitamins. Chronic, lifelong, malignant pain. How does, you know, because you want to be solving something that someone picks up and tries and uses and then picks it up again and again and again. So the more it's a vitamin, they should use it, but they don't. And so that's a huge signal. The fourth lens is the 10X factor, which is most companies go to an asset sale in the startup world. So if you took away all the revenue and all the value, is there an element to the business that's impossible to run? Because that's really what you want to asymmetrically invest in, that 10X factor, so that when the dust settles, you have something that's so disruptive. It's not one or two times better that can be copied, but 10X. And lastly is permanence, which is, can you both by intention and value, you know, build a monopoly? Can you be, you know, in the life of a customer for at least 3 or 4 years? If both by execution strategy and outcome, you can survive those lenses, you can build a company, a solution to a customer problem through those, you have a very, very good shot at building a big company and having one that's sustainable and successful for a long period of time. So it's an incredibly powerful experience, and it's one now I'm building Bionic through, but it's also the same sort of mindset and systems mechanics that we're working with, you know, direct with the leadership teams of P&G and Citi and General Mills and Nike and others who are also going through kind of the great refounding of their organizations as they try to disrupt themselves and be more competitive in this era.
The level of interviews that you did in this book is amazing. Elon Musk, as you mentioned, Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz, Tony Hsieh, Jay Walker, who never talks anymore. He's the guy who created Priceline, incredibly brilliant. I think people completely forgot how brilliant he is because other people have talked louder than him. But wow, what he was, how did you get all these people? How'd you connect with them?
I have a very good network and I've built, I believe, kind of like deep, authentic relationships for a long period of time. Also, one of the great sort of like life hacks for creating value is to actually ask for things. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that in relation with people, and I'm guilty of this, which is if you don't ask something to do something, they can't feel valued and they want to be valued. And so when you ask somebody for something, the chances are they're going to say yes. And so, but I think people don't understand that that's where that relational value can be formed because no one wants to ask each other for things or they feel like it's, they don't deserve it. And so when you get through those things, you can get very good at helping people need people because you catalyze an outcome for each other.
You know, that's the thing that's going to stay with me. That and the way that you were with me when you were in difficult situations and you needed to postpone. But I don't ask for things. And you're right. When someone asks me for something, especially somebody who I care about, I feel more valued, more connected to them, more invested in their success. And I hesitate to ask. I hate it.
Yeah. Well, the other side of not asking is that it leads to relationship isolation. So as a CEO or a husband or a father, if I don't ask the most important people in my life for anything, how will you ever be known? How will they ever feel needed? How will they ever feel part of your success or not? And when it doesn't work, by the way, because it very often you go through chapters where everything's working and then it doesn't, you know, they'll also be angry at you because you didn't ask when it was good. Like, how come you didn't help me solve that problem? I didn't know you needed this. Mm-hmm. And you're late. And either that's by pride or stupidity or fear, you didn't want to, you wanted to hold all the struggle. You wanted to hold all of the pain and quite frankly, sometimes the success. And that separates you. And so asking for things is an iconic idea that everyone needs, but it's really, it's what you need. Mm-hmm. And it creates the tensile strength to actually take on great challenges and do it together.
I'm going to talk about my second sponsor and then we'll see what happened. You took another break and then you came back again, refreshed, and life changed too. I'll first tell you, my second sponsor is a company called TopTal. Great place to hire developers. You know, just a little while ago, I interviewed an entrepreneur who created AMZ Tracker. And I said, how did you get this thing to a place where you could sell it for $11.5 million? You're a guy who was selling like pills before, you know, supplements. You're just getting started in entrepreneurship. How'd you build the software company that you were able to sell so fast? He said, I found the right developer. The guy coded the whole thing up by himself. You won't believe it, Andrew. You'd think we had a whole team. It's just him. I said, well, what was it about him? He said, there's some people who just want to solve the problem. Some people who just have that gift. He said, before then, if you would have said 10X developer, I would have said it's another one of these Silicon Valley phrases that really don't mean anything but help justify a culture of San Francisco. But he said, I saw him. He built this whole business and now they're still co-founders in other businesses investing together. The reason that I bring them up in a TopTal ad is because as we're building up our companies, we are going to be ready for these developers who can have that kind of an impact on our business. Those developers don't come from going to cheap freelance sites. Those developers do come from long-term relationships, a lot of prep, a lot of searching. And if you don't have time to do that, you should know that the TopTal people, that's all they do. And if you go to toptal.com/mixergy, you could press a button, schedule a call with one of their matchers, and then they'll set you up with a call, a Zoom like we're doing right now, where you can talk to a developer who fits your exact needs and will either blow your mind and you can get started with them or doesn't. And then you move on and you haven't lost anything. But your mind will be blown. And one of the things that they're offering Mixergy people is 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period, because they're so convinced that this will change your business and that Mixergy people keep signing up for long-term agreements with their developers that they just want to keep fostering the relationship they have with my audience. So if you want to get started with them, go to top is in top of your head, tal is in talent, toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. How long did you take off? What type of vacation? How long did you stay away from work?
About a year, 10 months. The book came out and So a little under a year. And I, one of my close friends and most admired people I have in the world is a woman named Beth Comstock. And she was the vice chairman of GE. She ran all global innovation. And so she, this is now 7-8 years ago. And so the book came out and she invited me to come join a panel at her global leadership team meeting in Boca Raton. They call it a GLM conference. I had no idea what this was. And it turned out when I showed up in flip-flops, it was a lot bigger deal than I realized. There was 800 people there. GE's at the time had like 90 billion in the bank and 300,000 employees, huge, like bigger than the GDP of South Africa at the time. And so I'm at a panel at the end of this talk. She buys 800 copies of the book, which was great. And she asks me, she says, you know, what are your big questions as an outsider? And so at the time, Jeff Immelt was the CEO, and I kind of pointed out to Jeff, and I said, Jeff, you know, how many $50 million did you launch last year? And I said, I bet the answer is zero.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question? Because we lost the connection for a sec.
I said, like I said to the CEO of GE at the time, I said, how many $50 million companies did you launch last year? I said, I bet the answer is zero. And if that's true, I would be totally terrified. Like, how is that possible with the amount of capital in the bank and these 300,000 employees? How come that doesn't happen all the time? So of course it's like totally dead. And Beth says, you know, tell us how you really feel. And people nervously laugh. And I got off stage and you know, to his credit, Jeff got out of his seat and came backstage and he said, fix this. And he went back on stage and he said, that's the most important question in 37 years since Jack Welch, the now the late Jack Welch, started this conference. And 2 months later, he wrote to all 980,000 shareholders that he's, based on the Lean Startup and Startup Playbook, inspiring this change. And so for the next year, I just travel all the world doing growth mindset keynotes, then doing Lean Startup with Eric. And it was really the Eric show in a lot of ways. But what I learned was, is that, you know, these leaders were thinking that they had an employee problem. We need to go get people to do Lean Startup and become entrepreneurs. But when you went into the organization, what the employee said is like, you know, we don't have an employee problem. Like it's the mindset of leaders. The permission is not here. It's the addiction to being right. It's the imperialism. And so in really a very unique kind of single meeting moment with now the CEO, Baker Hughes, started to frame up what now is Bionic, which is the idea that venture capital and entrepreneurship are forms of management. And so we built growth boards that used large companies seed leadership with the mindset mechanics as if and the stages of venture, seed, ABC, to become the funding architecture that allowed them to go from a view of the world that was, I call it TAM to TAP, from a total addressable marketplace view of the world where share and behavior lives and budget, to portfolio theory, total addressable problems and needs. And instead of doing 5 big bets a year that McKinsey teaches you, you do 100 that, you know, with a 90% failure rate. And the reason why this is so important is, not only do you need to get to commercial truth, which most large organizations' employees don't say the truth because the cost of failure is too high, but you have to use portfolio theory, which means you make all of your money from the fewest number of bets. And when you go back to the beginning and you say, how do we make all our money? Each of those decisions have two qualities. One, high conviction. Why us? Why now? And number two is non-consensus. You make all of your money from the highest disagreement rate because it's new to you. So conversely, consensus is a growth killer. And so model solves that both in capability and in model.
Let me go back to the first thing that you said. You asked him, how many $50 million startups did you create last year? Why is it a big deal that he created none? I mean, he's got a huge bank account, great reputation. He can go and acquire the companies that make it to $500 million.
Well, the reason why it's so important is that those little $50 million companies are not worth 50. They're worth an order of magnitude more. They're the new oxygen. If that new oxygen is just acquired, just brought in from the outset, mm-hmm. In most cases, the company is late to doing it. So it's balance sheet destruction. The second is they don't know why. They're not changing the genetics of the company. The genetics of the company aren't learning. They're not learning organizations. And in a marketplace with as much disruption as we see going on, and as Eric often says, whoever learns the fastest wins. You know, that speed, that velocity is really what should shape all decision-making every single day. So it's sort of like Jeff Bezos talks about the day one mindset where the energy and structure, is the most, powerful on the first day. The top 7 companies in the world today, with the exception of one, are all software companies, all led by the founders. And the only one that's not is led by Satya Nadella, which is the growth mindset leader in the world. So there's got to be something in that. And the answer is there is. They have a completely different operating system running those companies than the top five conglomerates of the world that were most valued in the last kind of 20, 30 years. That efficiency and optimization has been solved. It's the big to bigger. And guess what? It's also defeated growth. It's destroyed growth. And so you have to be able to do both create and operate to create success in this era.
Okay. Well, by the way, Apple is also not a software company and also not run by the founder, right?
Well, I have to say that it's still a scaled startup. You have a founder-led company now that is led by the scaler, in this case, Tim Cook. Not unlike, the Microsoft era, which was Gates, the founder, the scaler was
Ballmer.
Steve Ballmer. And he missed two of the most, despite the fact it went from 30 to 80 billion, which was incredibly successful. They also missed two of the biggest disruptions in computing history, cloud and mobile. So you can be winning and losing. And that's a big question, which is Apple winning but losing? The refounding job is really getting back to the that outside-in customer problem through the world as opposed to maximizing gains.
Okay, so I get now you're going out and you're giving talks, you're helping people see how they could breathe the startup mindset into their organization. Portfolio theory means you're showing them how to create multiple startup. I see that you maybe I'm getting some of this wrong. I'll tell you what
I happen to evangelize the company that way, but Bionic has the system.
Well, it's what I want to do is get to, at what point did you start to sell something beyond you on stage telling them they should do different?
Yeah, there's a reason why it's called Bionic and doesn't have any of myself, the founder's name on it. It really is, Bionic is the company, and it manifests that these components, these four components of a growth OS do the job of that new to big, that zero to $100 million job that most large organizations have eradicated. We're installing it as a service or coaching model that creates the capability. And those four components are great portfolios. We call it discovery. The skill of, we call it validate, but lean entrepreneurship. So building your special forces for growth. This third is the growth board, which is the funding model, which replicates a venture model of funding, both mindset mechanics that allow leadership to invest in non-consensus, high conviction portfolio theory. And then the fourth element is just the capability, which is how do you go fast? Like you need the functions, you need the policy, you need the communication, all the kind of guts of the machine to set down the wall and pick up the fight, so to speak, right? And to stop being at war with growth and pick up the fight to put the company on offense. That capability is that fourth piece. Those four things represent the OS conceptually. And then at an operating rhythm today, it's scaled across some of the biggest companies in the world. I mean, these organizations are launching dozens, in some cases, hundreds of startups as a way of working. There's solutions and new needs. And so
did you find one company and say, I'm going to come in here, my company will come in here, and we're going to create one startup and then we'll expand that to a portfolio or something else?
It's not about the startup. It's the capability. It's the organizational capability, the model that goes and unlocks organization to go take on customer needs and problems using the funding model, both mindset mechanics and the skill of entrepreneurship as a way of working. What happens is they don't launch one startup, they launch hundreds.
And they literally, the first person who bought into this launched hundreds?
At scale after 3 or 4 years, yes.
Wow. And then your part in it, Bionic's part, I mean, was what? To teach them how to set this up?
Yeah, we bring all the IP, all the tools, the models, the coaching to create it as a permanent capability. It's like we're the spine and the ribs and a couple of the organs. They put the muscle and the skin on it. So it's called, Growth Works at P&G, D10X at Citigroup, Valiant Labs at Nike.
ZX Ventures at Anheuser-Busch.
Exactly.
Why do they all have their own names? Why are they creating their own organization that's separate?
Honestly, they're the hero of the journey. Like, they have to have ownership of this stuff.
Why is it its own branch? It seems like maybe what they're doing is creating almost like an accelerator within their company. The accelerator gets its own name, like D10X at Citigroup. Is that right? And then you go
accelerator. There's a lot of language out here. It's kind of complex. So there's accelerators, there's incubators, there's venture groups. this is really how do you organize all of those things as a capability. So how do we think? How do we fund? How do we do the work? And how do we go? How do we create the organizational capability, make it permanent? So those elements have to be in place. So whether you have an accelerator, you have labs, you do venture, without the context of like, why are we investing? What's the need in the world we're solving for? You know, what is the grand challenge we're solving? Without that context and a funding model, you feel like you're thinking you got 100 things going on and you're asking why? Why am I spending all this money? Or why is nothing dying, right? Why am I lighting my money on fire?
And so do you go in as consultants and teach them this? Do you have your own team that works with them?
Yeah, I mean, we think of ourselves as a kind of a product-enabled service company. And so consulting, in my view, is like my friend Vanessa says this all the time. It's like that's like theoretical physics. It's like, you know, it's like you show up with a bunch of physics they kind of would like to do, but they can't understand. This is just applied physics. It's like, it's the people, it's the tools, it's the operating rhythm, it's the radical outsiders. That drive of a repeat process that helps them do this work is what unlocks the organization. So you can talk about growth mindset and inspire them all day long. It's the systems that actually make the change because they happen as a skill and a muscle because they're doing it.
Okay. Is there one concrete example that you can point to and say, because of this mindset, because of this system, here's a big company that people will know and here's what they came up with?
Well, it's now public, but I mean, ZX is a great example. I mean, we've been with them for 5 years, one of the greatest efficiency organizations in the world, right? And they knew they were being disrupted, both in the world of beer, but also the needs of their customers. And we helped join them in standing up ZX Ventures in the early days. And, you know, they went from sort of 12 to a couple thousand people, and they just publicly announced and they crossed $1 billion in revenue. So, you know, the difference is that revenue is kind of new oxygen, right? Versus the oxygen you're breathing. So it has different value, but it's put the whole organization on offense. So the other thing it's done is, and this is true, I think, for a lot of our partners, is they've spent their lifetime, you know, building a mountain of customers, solving a problem. And when that mountain of customers starts to die, right, it's scary, right? Mm-hmm. It starts to shrink and you work harder, plan harder, you market harder, everything's harder, right? And the reason why they do that is because that's what they know. They know operating, they know efficiency. And the challenge is that the reason why it doesn't work is because the customers are leaving their mountain and they're blind to it. They don't have the capability to discover it. They don't know where the need went or the behavior went because they have a view of the world that actually limits the permission to go answer what is the need, how did the need change. To do that, you have to look at outside forces. What are the outside forces that changed the need in the world that my customer left me from to? And if I don't have a capability like ZX or D10X to go do the work of discovery, all I have is my big to bigger planning skill. And that's a massive liability when there's change in the world.
Okay. And so ZX Ventures is from Anheuser-Busch InBev. What they do is they've got a portfolio of products that are almost the opposite of everything that Anheuser-Busch is known for. They've got a portfolio of products that includes craft beer companies that have the reputation that it takes to sell a craft beer. I think they've got a hard seltzer brand in there, or Highball Energy, which does mm-hmm. hard alcohol. Yep. That's different.
Babe Rosé, all this stuff. Yeah.
Babe Rosé. And so that's what it is. By working through this organization, they could come up with new ideas that don't replace what they've got. Well, maybe I guess at some point replace it, but they're thinking differently and creating things that are outside of what got them where they are now.
Yeah. I mean, what you're doing is that you're creating the model and permission where the leadership can invest and fund and needs the world without having to know all the answers. It breaks the addiction of being right. Because you have to be question-driven leadership when you're doing small little things that you value, because it's like raising a child. You know, it's like zero to, you know, it's like a zygote to 5-year-old to 10-year-old and ugly teenager. That's like a seed ABC round. Every one of those stages is a completely different set of questions. But they're not coming in answers. They're coming in questions because you can't ask a little kid, how fast can you run? That's like saying, what's your IRR? What's your marketplace value? What's your, you know, what are your metrics? You know, and nor can you give them, you know, even worse, which is, you know, I'll feed you if you can promise to be an Olympian, which is ridiculous, right? It's unknowable. So you know, you have to create a model that allows you to run a very large volume experiments with a lot of failure, productive failure, so you get to the truth to answer questions, should we do this? That's not planning. And so that skill, the mindset mechanics, the lenses I talked about earlier, you're looking through a completely different set of lenses and a different questions to be able to answer the question, how big could this be? What's a proprietary gift and should we do it? And that's what the model does.
All right. The website for anyone who wants to go follow up with Bionic, it's onbionic.com.
Yeah. So that's the one for the company. If you want to see my speaking, it's davidskidder.com. And then there's all the books have different websites with another title, but those two are the primary ones. And, you know, I'm happy to share the story to that's helpful to anybody's needs. There's a lot of people, and this goes transcends even business. I think there's a lot of the work we're doing about igniting growth is really about the interior life of the leader. It's not just the money and the startups. It's really about themselves. They are the ceiling. They are the permission of change. And I think that's a human thing. I think it's a human experiment as much as it is an economic one.
The book where you get into that, it, I feel like the one that I first found out about you because of is the Intellectual Devotional. Uh-huh. Yeah, right? Is that yeah. the one that put you on the map, that got you in people's heads?
That was it. That, well, for me, it was a, it really proved the, it really is an eye opener because it was very, it's, it still is a very, very successful book. It's in 18 languages. It's what, literally this last year, 10 years later, the first one's in the top books in all of Japan. We did five of them and, they're really 5 minute a day readings, you know, so every Monday was history, Tuesday was literature, Wednesday, philosophy, science, math. And I wrote the book because I needed it. Like, you know, that was listening to your ideas because of your need. And so I wrote it with a co-author and, who I love and illustrated it, spent a year in my basement drawing all the images, got me back to the design fine arts after being away for a long time. And, you know, it was like literally number one for a while. So it was really incredible success. And, it really taught me to value that voice, value what you deeply care about, value your needs. You're probably not alone in the world for that need. And, you know, success favors those who act. And so so many people literally just don't act. And so the dog, you know, setting yourself for the dog that caught the car, go get the contract, force yourself to do it, commit, creates extraordinary outcomes. And that book really taught me how to value that, but also to lead myself and how to commit and get back to the things that I cared about.
And the premise of the book is religious people have some devotional that they read every day, a couple yep. of pages that reconnects them with their spiritual selves. You say somebody who wants on an intellectual level to work on themselves should have something similar. And so that's what you did. And it covers, I see history, science, religion. Is this Noah? Yeah. From the book of Genesis. All right. That's where I first found out about you. And I had no idea there was so much more behind the man who wrote the book.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that book is in more bathrooms than, you know, most books in the world today. It's kind of hilarious. It's a great tool. And I love it. And people teach to it. I was at a dinner party at TED 12, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And I was at a dinner party with a bunch of like 10 people. And one of them was a very famous actress. And she said, did you know, like, Steven Spielberg gives this book out as his holiday gift every year.
Wow.
And my response was, how would I ever know that? Like, am I in Steven Spielberg's holiday list? So it has this very interesting, funny cult following and just karmic connection in the world that I get a chance to run into periodically, which always amuses me. But yeah, it's good. It's fun.
The book is The Intellectual Devotional. It's available everywhere. I want to thank you so much for being here. Thanks, David. I know you've got so much to take care of right now. We're going to figure out what's going to happen to the economy now.
I know it's a noble thing, but it does. I think the with abundance mindset, you have a lot of choices that there's a lot of opportunity, and we have to we got to solve it. So we're into a new era. So I hope this era is good for you and good for all of your listeners, and it certainly will be for us. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, everyone. Bye.